lots and lots in the paper about Brexit and about Brexit fears and our preparation for Brexit, and that we seem to be possibly getting closer and closer to a no deal or a hard border. And indeed there were some grim warnings from government this week as to the damage a no deal Brexit would do to our economy. But what about the threats of a hard border to peace and stability in Northern Ireland? So if there is any kind of border infrastructure rebuilt between the North and the Republic, it could be a target for criminals and or dissidents. That's the stark warning from my first guest this morning, PSNI Chief Constable George Hamilton, who retired this week after 5 years at the top and indeed after 34 years as a police officer. So like so many people on both sides of the Troubles, he has suffered pain and loss himself. As a young constable, he held a colleague in his arms as he died, a memory he thinks about every day. More recently, he's had to deal with the profoundly shocking murder of Lyra McKee in the Craigan in Derry, a bullet that, let's not forget, was meant for one of his police officers. And of course, he's faced criticism over the lack of progress on legacy issues. So earlier this week, I spoke to him. I asked him first just how real are those threats from criminals if there was to be a new border after a no-deal Brexit?
Well, the Commissioner from Garda Síochána and I talk about this on a regular basis. I think there will be implications with Brexit, and the policing job is to identify those consequences and implications and plan towards them. So a no-deal is going to be more challenging in that it will create additional opportunities for organised criminality to exploit any differentiation between tariffs, for example. It'll also have a potential impact on the movement of goods more generally and potentially people. We need to wait and see exactly what shape or form. You know, I'm pretty confident policing on both sides of the border will stand ready for that challenge, and we shouldn't catastrophise to such an extent that even a no-deal Brexit would necessitate a return to the sort of security apparatus and the border of yesteryear.
Drew Harris was talking about the fact that the reality of what's ahead. He talked about armed support at the border, for example. Are we going to see the return of that kind of securitisation of the border?
Well, I don't think so. I think what we'll see, there will be operational consequences, and what Drew Harris has said, I concur with completely, that there will need to be an increase in resources. Of course, the two police services have slightly different responsibilities. I, in the north, do not have responsibility for immigration control, whereas in Garda Síochána does have that as part of their responsibility. But even that relatively small issue aside, the potential for organised crime to exploit this difference between the two jurisdictions in terms of excise and tariffs and so on may well necessitate increased police resources to address that.
Specifically, you don't see that, though, as an increased armed presence along the border?
Well, in the north here, sadly, and still much to my regret, the service is still generally armed anyway. So we want to see...
Would you have expected, say, when you started the job, your 5 years there, would you have expected by now the force not to be armed, or vast tracts of the force not to be armed at this stage?
I can't honestly answer that question, because we were sitting in a severe terrorist threat 5 years ago. That is, that the threat of an attack was highly likely. Certainly, I can remember back to days of more positivity and optimism when PSNI was formed in the early 2000s. And back then, as a senior officer in charge of Belfast, for example, I certainly had an expectation, and we were having discussions about the need for the removal of officers to routinely carry firearms. Of course, like with any other police service across the world, there's always going to need to be an armed capability. But that notion of officers needing to carry a firearm for personal protection was something that we all had hoped would have moved with the peace process to such an extent that that's no longer possible.
So if I can use the word normal, would you have expected by now a more normal society up there and a more normal police force?
Well, that's sort of what we're working towards. And as I say, when I look back to the early days, the post-Good Friday Agreement, the creation of the PSNI, that's exactly what many of us who supported all of that peace accord and so on had in mind, that we would have an entirely normalised policing arrangement. We have moved significantly towards that, and I think this requires hard work and resilience and optimism, but actually we're not there yet, and I'm not going to pretend that we are, and I wish actually that we were further on. Things are better, they're improving, but actually there's still a long journey to travel in terms of fully normalising police service.
Okay, if the threat of an attack was highly likely 5 years ago, what do you think the level of threat is currently?
Well, it's formally assessed at exactly the same level, actually, which is a concern, and it's been there for a decade now, so this is a concern for us. What we're not going to do, though, is fall into the trap of responding to that threat with heavy-handed, securitised policing. Yes, we will need to do difficult and challenging operations against violent dissident Republicans, and we've had significant success against them, but, of course, The violent dissidents only need to get lucky once to have absolutely catastrophic consequences. We've seen that recently with the murder of Liam McKee in Derry. We have been doing lots around that, but what we actually need is, it's more than a policing response to this. We need political leadership. We need communities to narrow the space that these people walk on. They should not have legitimacy around their use of violence. It's perfectly valid for people to hold a dissident view, that is, a non-mainstream, non-Sinn Féin Republican perspective. The problem comes, and where they can never have any legitimacy, is when their aspirations for reunification of the island, or however they want to describe it, when they use that as an excuse for killing fellow citizens, whether they be journalists or police officers, at one level, it doesn't matter. That is just wrong, can never be right, and it's not legitimate, and we should be careful not to give them any legitimacy or energy in those violent endeavours.
Did you feel, and I think there was a general feeling, the widespread revulsion around the murder of Liam McKee, there was a sense that the community, even in the Craig and the immediate community, were saying, no, okay, enough of this. And there was talk of that more people were coming forward with information from the community, and that we could be at some kind of a tipping point where the likes of the dissidents were losing their legitimacy in the community. Has that played out as we would have hoped over the last while, or was that moment of hope kind of gone?
Well, I don't know. I do think that people in Derry and Craigan, in those neighbourhoods that were most directly affected by Lyra's murder, I do think that there has been a change. Whether or not it's the sea change that we had all hoped for, whereby these people would simply not be able to operate within those communities. I mean, part of that is because of the sort of intimidation that they bring to bear and the demonising of everything that is not their perspective, including their own communities. So this is a very significant problem. I think the approach that those violent dissidents have taken has been to, you know, blame everybody else for their own murderous act. And I appeal to communities and to politicians to call that out for what it is, because, and well, what we saw, I mean, there's some very powerful manifestations of Not In Our Name, and those powerful women putting their hands into the blood red paint and daubing it onto the walls of the Ciro office.
Yes, but
those are very powerful voices speaking at that time. I think it's
agreed. Have you seen a change though on the ground in the months since then? Have you seen increased cooperation? Do you think that the dissidents are more under pressure in these communities? I mean, what's your intelligence about their operations at the moment?
Well, I have to say, sadly, and I would like to be saying something else, but we haven't seen any let up in violent dissident Republican activity. We've seen continued further attacks. Thankfully, they've been unsuccessful. We have seen prevented bombings and shootings and so on. And so that tells me that we should not be complacent. I don't think we have crossed any significant lines in terms of major disruption to these dissidents. And for me, it seems that it's really important that communities don't forget what these people are really like. And they can't, because actually they're meeting out more pain and intimidation and thuggery on their own communities than anybody else. It's not as if these people are guardians of their own community. These people are terrorists. They're involved in criminality. Many of them are involved in drugs and extortion and so on. And they're meeting that out. So there is a big responsibility on all of us, including the police service, around an enforcement piece, around securing enough evidence to bring charges against these people. But in doing that, we need to have cooperation, and we need to have witnesses, forensic evidence and so on. Now, I don't want to say too much about the Lara McKee investigation, other than it's still ongoing. We haven't given up on that. There will be more activity around that in coming days. And there has been a real difference in terms of the level of cooperation and support between community and police around that investigation, and I welcome that, of course.
Okay, and the guarantees of anonymity that you have offered to people coming forward, is that helping?
Well, it seems to be. I don't think there's any one single factor. I think the nature of the attack, the nature of the victim in Lara, frankly, is this very young, beautiful, progressive journalist outdoing her job. I don't mean it would have been justified in any way had it been a police officer killed, mm-hmm. but what I'm saying is I think a number of factors around the specifics of that case meant that communities, potential witnesses, saw this differently. And I do think that the police service was more responsive and hopefully more community intelligent and culturally intelligent in our approach. So things like taking a mobile facility to the area to secure phone footage, for example, and photographs on phones, rather than this sort of sinister feeling of the police seizing people's devices, their phones and their tablets, and taking them away for months on end. So there's been an increased responsiveness from the police service. I think there's been, quite rightly, total revulsion from the community. We had a lot of very powerful voices. Father McGill at Lara's funeral made this different. A number of factors made this case different. And, you know, I'm hoping that out of all of that, we will be able to harvest enough information to bring charges and prosecutions against those responsible.
George, you alluded to it there. The bullet that killed Lara McKee was presumably meant to kill one of your people. And is that the reality that your colleagues still live with every day?
Yes, in fact, just a few weeks ago, a current serving officer discovered on a Saturday morning after his round of golf that a bomb had been placed under his car. It was a fully viable device. It did not activate for some reason. It's currently the subject of forensic investigation. But it had all the component parts. It was a viable device. And had it exploded, it would have killed him and potentially other people in the vicinity. So this is an ongoing, you know, nobody's talking this up. Sometimes I've been accused of, you know, talking up the threat worse than it is. I would love the threat to be lower than it is. We long for normalised policing, a normal operating environment where we don't have to wear ballistic body armour and carry guns and all of that. You know, we don't want to be at war with anyone. And in the middle of it, these people who want to take us back to the past, want to create conflict, want to create a sense of war against the British or the police or whatever. I mean, that's a mindset of 40 years ago. It didn't work then. It'll not work now. And what does really impress me is the restraint and the resilience of police officers. We have police officers going into some of these more challenging areas where these dissidents operate, and they're going in high visibility jackets on pedal cycles, trying to deliver a community policing service. And that's really challenging because on one hand, I'm telling them, you need to go and build confidence, fairness, courtesy, respect, partnership working, problem solving with communities. And on the other hand, we're telling them, be really careful out there because there's people who want to kill you. And it's a real mixed message, but that is the reality of post-conflict Northern Ireland.
You are sending your men and women out every day with the knowledge that there are people out there who want to kill you. In your time in the RUC first and then the PSNI, you must have lost friends and colleagues, did you?
Yeah, that would be the case. And I suppose, you know, I'm gonna leave this job in a day or two's time, and it is a time of reflection and looking back. And I do look back to coffins that I've carried and walked behind, and friends that I've lost, and families that I've seen grow up without their dads. You know, I did have the experience as a young constable of, you know, holding a colleague as he died in my arms, for example. I've maintained contact with his family. I think about that incident every day. I have my own mechanisms for dealing and coping with that. You know, I remember well carrying that coffin and other coffins.
How old were you when that happened?
19, 20, something like that.
You were 19 or 20 and you held a friend of yours in your arms while he died.
That
must be a very hard thing to move on from and to get back in your uniform and go back into work after something like that happens.
Well, there are challenges with that. I've had wonderful support throughout the days of the RUC and into the PSNI, and policing has had massive losses in terms of lives lost. But the strange thing is we tend to deal with it in a personal, quiet way. And other people, and I'm not criticising them, by the way, I think they're perfectly justified in doing this, but in loss, you long for someone to blame, someone to be held to account and so on. And policing, I don't think, has moved into that space to the same extent. We have consumed much of that loss and much of that grief. We have actually travelled a very uncomfortable journey despite all of that sacrifice, doing things like agreeing that it's time to actually change these symbols, change this name, have a new attestation, change a uniform, all of those sort of cultural and symbolic things. Many of us that have actually delivered that change agreed to do it, even though we ourselves were victims of that violence. And so I can understand the small number of colleagues who think that they were sold out, that the policing reforms were a mark of disrespect. I don't see it that way personally. I see it as a necessary progression as part of the peace process. But there is a story in there that doesn't get ventilated much about our own loss and our own suffering. So despite massive reductions in our police budget, one of the areas of growth that I identified early in my tenure was that we would invest in our people, in their welfare, in their well-being, because we are a deeply traumatised organisation. And not only that, we tend to take responsibility or get blamed for just about everything that goes wrong in the imperfect peace process. So a lot of the challenges around legacy, for example, tend to land at our feet, and then occasionally we'll make mistakes. It's a human endeavour, and things will go wrong, and conspiracy theories are attached to that. So you've got all of this happening. On top of all of that, they've got their own burden, their own story, their own private grief, their loss, their physical injuries. And, you know, the whole impact on people's mental health in coming along that journey is, I suppose, the human side of policing that, as I reflect back, we have just soaked up rather than trying to offer a human story to that. And so I'm glad you've raised it this morning, Brendan.
It strikes me that you seem, underneath the surface, you seem quite angry and quite bitter as you leave this job.
Pretty much the opposite. I'm being authentic, genuine, and honest. I don't feel any anger or bitterness. I feel hugely honoured to have held the position of Chief Constable, and you know, I think it's been important that we're part of the peace process, that the changes to policing are something to be very positive about. We want to be held to account. I didn't want to lead an organisation that wasn't representative of the communities that it's served. We've made some progress on that. We see some risks to that looking into the future. So rather than waiting for that to happen, we flagged it up publicly and to the politicians. I feel very positive about the organisation that I'm leaving behind. We've got crime performance at the best it's ever been. We've public confidence in policing, the highest it's ever been. Complaints against police, the lowest they've ever been. We're more diverse, we're more representative than we've ever been.
Okay,
and we've had £150 million taken out of the budget in delivering all of that. So I feel positive. I feel honoured to have held the position. I think I'm handing the organisation over to a new chief constable in a very healthy state.
Okay, let's deal with some of those things you mentioned, some of the challenges you mentioned and some of the issues you talked about just there. So on the legacy side of things, it seems to me as if you're saying that the PSNI is being unfairly blamed for problems around legacy issues. But can you see the other side of this, like in cases like Sean Graham's Bookmakers, where the PSNI failed to reveal significant information about the attack? And can you understand then why people like Tommy Duffin, who lost his father Jack in the attack, says this is a cover-up after cover-up of RUC special branch collusion? Can you see why people would see it that way?
I can see why people would see it that way. On the Sean Graham's Bookies atrocity, the disclosure issues around that, and the material that was not disclosed to the Ombudsman but was disclosed to lawyers in civil proceedings. We dropped the ball on that. That was a mistake, and we've apologised. And I can understand why families would not necessarily accept our apology, why they would see this as one in a long series of things that have gone wrong, that they would attach a conspiracy to it. I'm saying there is no conspiracy. I have said all along that this organisation is not properly equipped or resourced to deal with the legacy issues. I want that taken away from us and given to a proper, fit, independent organisation, properly constituted with the intention of dealing with legacy. I've been asking for that for 5 years and it hasn't been delivered. I also am saying that the scale of the legacy challenge is such, between criminal justice investigations, coronial inquests, civil litigation, police ombudsman's investigation, all of that. This is a complete monster. The scale of it is huge. The amount of material that we hold, approximately 45 million individual pieces of paper, that's just the sensitive material, the secret material, the intelligence. On top of that, there are old, archaic IT systems that are little more than storage facilities. They're not very searchable. They're not well indexed. It needs massive investment. It needs an organisation to come in and do some serious problem solving. We're not equipped to do that. We're not resourced to do it. And in the middle of that chaos, I have said to people before, this is how it is. I'm being honest about it.
Okay.
Don't be surprised when we drop the ball. Don't be surprised when we make a mistake.
You've also said recently that you're not in favour of it, but you would live with an amnesty. What would that look like to you?
Well, the point that I was trying to make was that the Attorney General here in the North and the former Director of Public Prosecutions, Barry McGrory, made certain commentaries about the likelihood of successful criminal prosecutions. And they in their utterances came to a conclusion, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but if I'm recalling correctly, of drawing a line under these criminal investigations, or that criminal prosecutions was not the way forward. That was immediately dismissed in most political voices. And the point that I was making was that there was something in that that needed to be explored. There should be a mature debate, because actually the criminal law dealing with cases this old, when witnesses have died or got decaying memories, or when evidence has been lost or destroyed or blown up in bombs or whatever, what I'm saying is we need to have a realistic stock take of what these investigations are likely to bring. So even if we get a case where, and we do have a small percentage, it's single-figure percentages where we get a successful prosecution, but even in those cases, when a person is convicted, if they're a member of a paramilitary organisation that is deemed to have ceased violence, the maximum sentence they're going to receive is 2 years imprisonment. Now, not everybody, first of all, wants a criminal prosecution. But for those that do, they will not see a 2-year sentence for the murder of their loved one to be justice. So the peace process has perhaps inadvertently brought us to a place where that form of conventional criminal justice outcome is almost impossible. People are not going to get closure through seeing any individual or all of the individuals involved in the murder of their loved one going to prison for a life sentence.
You talked a minute ago, you mentioned trust in the community. I suppose the legacy issue is one of the issues that has probably damaged trust between the nationalist community and the PSNI. After you announced your retirement, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald said that nobody from the PSNI would be acceptable as your successor, and she mentioned the legacy issues. Has the PSNI lost the confidence of the major nationalist party and big tracts of the nationalist community?
Well, 82% of people surveyed independently, or sorry, 86% of people surveyed independently across the jurisdiction have confidence in PSNI. I accept that there will be specific things that will have a negative impact on confidence in certain constituencies.
For example, do you think the arrest of Gerry Adams during an election campaign, was that something that damaged trust?
Well, you know, I think it's important that a police service acts with integrity and follows the evidence and doesn't get influenced by these other factors, because we would end up being influenced by lots of political factors, and that wouldn't be appropriate. Our legitimacy comes from respect for the rule of law, going where the evidence takes us, and acting with integrity. So all of that, even if it is unpalatable, that is part of public service, of holding the office of constable, and of acting without fear or favour, not avoiding things just because of the profile of the person involved.
But you can see how people might have seen that as political policing, can you?
Well, yeah, I mean, people are entitled to their view, but that was done. We followed the evidence. We made an arrest. Mr. Adams was interviewed under caution, had all the safeguards that custody in this day and age provides, and he was released. You know, that's... If the community want the police service not to do things because it's unpopular or unpalatable, I think we would actually end up losing our legitimacy.
Do you think the legitimacy of the PSNI is being undermined still as well by the fact that 32% are currently Catholics? Of 68 people in senior management, only 8 of them are Catholics. Only 20% of new recruits in training are Catholics. You yourself have said that 32% will fall in the future unless something changes radically. Is that still a very real problem?
Well, we could argue about some of those figures, but I'm not going to do that. My point would be that this organisation needs to be representative of the community that serves. We want to be. That's not just lip service. There is a passionate desire within the senior leadership team of this organisation to make us as representative as we possibly can be, and we're not at the moment. We have worked hard at trying to find out why that is the case, but this will take time. What we need is people in leadership, particularly political leadership, but also faith groups, sporting associations, the business community. We need people to not just tolerate their friends and family joining a police service, but they actually become advocates for the noble profession of policing. When we get to that point, I think we will start to see changes in the representativeness.
I want to go back to where we started, which is the border. We talked about criminality there. How much of a threat is there, do you think, of a return to paramilitary violence around the border?
Well, I think the dissident groups would, if there was any infrastructure to be created at the border in a hard border type no deal exit, I think it's inevitable that dissidents would seek to exploit that. If there was infrastructure there, it would become a target, all of that. But You know, what I'm hearing from both governments and from the EU is that nobody has a desire to do any of that. And so that infrastructure, you know, everyone's saying that they don't want it, that it shouldn't be there. And if that's not going to happen, then there'll be nothing for them to attack. So,
but what do you think the alternative is? Boris Johnson is saying there's technical solutions. He can't seem to put his finger on them. Jeremy Hunt now is saying he will be pursuing a technology-led solution. To the best of your knowledge, is there any such solution available?
No, not that I'm aware of. So that takes you into the space of the best alternative, that is a negotiated agreement that makes sure that the trading arrangements, the movement arrangements, the regulatory framework between Europe and the UK is such that we don't need those things at the border. And that's why I'm hoping that whoever the next Prime Minister is has some success in negotiating an agreement that is acceptable within the UK, acceptable in Europe, so that we don't end up with a situation at the border that would attract attention from violent dissidents.
When you announced your retirement, you said Northern Ireland is now a much more peaceful and progressive society than it was when you joined policing 33 years ago, which is no doubt true. You also said, I think last week, that we're more polarised and people are in deeper trenches than 20 years ago. So do you think Northern Ireland is going backwards in terms of being a divided society?
When you look back on the progress that we have made since the Good Friday Agreement, we are absolutely transformed. We're in a much better place, and it is much more progressive. And I don't think there is any risk of us going back to the sort of period of the conflict where there was, we're going to have this rump of violent dissidents do what they do, and occasionally in their terms they'll be successful, but we will keep that suppression on the violent element of dissident activity, and hopefully with community support that will be dealt with. I don't see any real risk of going back to the big paramilitary organisations, well-structured, well-resourced, strategic thinking in them, all of that. I think there is no risk of us going back. Too much ground has been covered. When you look back at where we have been in the last sort of 5 years of my tenure, instead of the language coming from politicians being around optimism and progression and consensus and those sorts of words, they're tending to fall out over what feels like pretty marginal issues, things around the edges that seem to me pretty small compared to the really big difficult stuff that they compromised and agreed on back in the late 90s and the early 2000s.
So you think it's become quite petty between the politicians?
Yeah, well, I think the issues are important at one level for certain constituencies, but they're not worth collapsing governments over. And I can't understand why there was such courageous political leadership that got us to the 98 agreement and beyond, and got policing and justice devolved in 2010, and all of those big landmark compromises and risks that people took for the peace process. And then we get to the point where we are now, and people do seem more polarised. They're choosing to magnify differences rather than reduce them or compromise on them. And that's disappointing given the progress that we have made.
You were offered a contract extension of 3 years. And you chose not to take it. You're a young man. What are your plans now?
Well, the plan is to work out what comes next. I didn't not take the extension for any one big reason. It was more an accumulation of little things, I guess, that just made sense for me to move on at this stage. You said I am a young man, and I suppose that comparatively so, but young enough and hopefully healthy enough to do other things. And I think after 34 years in policing, it's been a huge honour to be the chief constable. It's been great to have served as a police officer, but it is a hard shift and takes its toll. And I wanted to leave when things were going well. I wanted to leave when I felt good about myself and the organisation. And I wanted to leave when I was young enough and had enough energy to do other things. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to be. I have no other work lined up. I do want to take maybe 4 or 5 months to decompress and work all of that out.
Okay, George Hamilton, thank you very much.